as I said, Bill Lassen was a senior judge. I think he may have been Chief Justice for a while. Skippy McCarthy, I think he was one of the courts. Jerry Lee Nordman, Norris, Ken Nyack was black, or dark, anyway. I don't know what his nationality was. Kathy Sanjean, those are all the women there. Mae Steele and Eileen Walden. She was at our last reunion. Alan Vanderberg has been a lawyer forever up in Women's Lane. I mean, I could go on all of these people one way and another, but I'm trying to think of any that are sort of especially important. They're all there, and there are very few of them left.
Was this an unusually small class?
Yes, it seemed the smallest class that ever went through UWC. Huh. That's my father could always remember this class because they were the smallest class that went through. I think about 50 people.
What would determine the size? I suppose.
Well, what happened was that the first years were full, felt much fuller than ours because they were veterans. Mm-hmm. I mean, the place was flooded with veterans, and as they got through, it went down to people who weren't veterans because veterans got special treatment. They got extra fees and all that for their living. Things like that.
For so many years, yeah. And then they weren't.
And then they faded out as veterans, and were in practice, but they it narrowed down to our class, which was the smallest, and then it gradually grew again. And there were some women in all the years, I think. In fact, in the very first class, there was the gold medalist. The winner was a gold winner. The top person was a woman, and I'm sure we'd have that on our. You have found that on the record somewhere. She got the gold medal. So we're not. There was an unwritten feeling from a lot of men, probably in women's opinion, that it was a really hard profession to break into, and they'd rather do something else. But every year some did, and then you could watch the thing come up to where it's been more women than men. I don't think we have those figures somewhere.
We've talked to Ann Rolls and mm-hmm. Pat Proudfoot.
Those are good people.
Yeah, yes, they were. They're
very nice.
I think they're a bit before you.
I think they're ahead of me. Where are they? I'm not sure whether I'm before or after them.
And there's a woman who we're trying to get hold of, Mary.
Mary, yes.
Judge.
Judge, yes.
Who doesn't have
Mary
email.
What's Mary Southern.
Mary Southern. Southern. Yeah. She stood out because she was known for being fairly strict in court about proper dress and things like that. She had a very good mind. She made a very good judge, but she was strict, sort of. And I don't think she'd have minded me saying that because that's what she was, and she was going to do that. She and my father got along great. They liked each other. Okay, where do we go from?
We could maybe talk a bit more about the class.
I think I was in the middle of some. Mm. That, generally speaking, we did our three classes in the morning, four classes in the morning, and then that was noon, you had your lunch, and then you went in the library, which was a nice library. It was pretty well right out here. A low building, I think it was a one-story building with a basement. It was a nice building. And the windows looked out on the water there. That was before that second awful building came. the windows, and you could see that the trees weren't high, and you could see the ferries going back and forth. I used to note when the ferries went back and forth, see if they're on time. when you're sitting in class, not in your mind, not on the law. So we had that building, and then gradually we had to go back to what we call the army huts, the old huts, and we had to make use of them for quite a while. There'd be two or three of those huts, and we only got out of them, probably still beside the school for a long time. And they were hot and steamy in the winter, and the registers, the old steam registers around the room would make noise, and you'd have to go over and kick them, do that to them. But we got affectionately to them after a while. the first building was a clean and nice new building, but it was only one story, and I think it had three classrooms and the library, and that was it. So 6 or 7 offices. The faculty was 7 people in the early days, and they're listed.
Boy, they must have worked hard.
Well, they taught. Every professor was expected to teach almost anything. Most of them taught 3 courses. And later on, I taught 3 courses.
You said in third year that you had a choice of a, what do you call it, an option. What was the...
Well, I could either have articled and gone straight into a law firm. I did article to Ferris & Company, which was one of the bigger firms. But I got a scholarship to Harvard, and that was what I did that year. And then I came back and article and had to make the choice whether I went into practice or whether I went into teaching, and I went into teaching.
Did you ever practice or at that stage?
No, except in the sense that when I was an article student, I did some trifling types of things that they threw, well, searching titles, which is what you may have to do sometimes.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was. The students used to, a lot of us had lunch downtown, and we were mostly chasing people who hadn't paid their debts, we were exchanging, you found that guy? Because he was always running away, we could never get him, and we'd keep our notes so that we could find, we gave our help to our other people if they found them out. A lot of the time was searching titles, which has to be incredibly boring. And now it's all it's done with computers, and all the registration is just like that. And that's made the old searching thing pretty well dead. I mean, you do have to check, but you're checking. You're not having to read a whole bunch of stuff to read it.
So these are land titles for house purchases or house.
Well, and any passing after a will or anything like that too. You had to always check the title for wills for people. What's they got? They got the land that they're supposed to get and this sort of thing. But you had to check it back. Sometimes a couple purchases to make sure there were no liens on it or mortgages on it. That's basically it. So a lot of our time was pretty boring, but we got used to land law that way. And maybe you did that until noon, and then afternoon you tried to find people who hadn't paid their rent and things like that. and you did little memos for your senior lawyer that you were articled to.
Yeah. Where was the Ferris office at that
state? It was on. It's still there. It was downtown, 510 West Hastings. I can still remember it. And there were 4 of us in the four of my class in that building in different law offices. So we had lunch together, usually over at the CPR, Superior Train Station there, for 80 cents.
Do you remember the other three?
Yes, Bill Essenhoffen, Alec Robertsonhoffen, Don Patterson. Don Patterson. Alec Robertson was a good friend of mine, and he was the treaty commissioner for some time, eventually. He practiced law in one of the two or three big firms, but then for like 5 or 6 years he was a treaty commissioner. That's about 10 years ago, I guess. And others of these are where on the bench or dead or wherever.
So did you live at home during...
I lived at home. I was lucky I was able to live at home. And almost all of us in those days, as soon as the last day of classes, we found a job downtown. And we mostly were in factories, mostly in mills and places like that. I spent 4 summers working in a shingle mill there, that made not wooden shingles, but duroid shingles, you know. And you worked on the line, and as the stuff was coming off in pieces, you bundled them and put wires around them and carried them somewhere. You got in good shape all summer, and I used to go out with a truck, what we call swamping, which the first time, I don't know where that word came from, but a swamper was the guy who went along to help the driver unload everything. So it was a sort of an on-off job. Sometimes you were swamping, sometimes you weren't. I hate to think of driving that, but a 10-ton truck a few times without a senior license.
I'm surprised they were making duroid shingles with the cedar.
Yeah, no, there were lots of mills, and they made shakes and things like that. They weren't right in the middle of the city. This one was right in the middle. This was at 10th and what's the cross street? McDonald's, just above. Remember the tracks did run in those days. You're crossing tracks in there somewhere. Of a McDonald's somewhere.
Arbutus.
Yeah. Arbutus. In fact, 10th and Arbutus was where my factory was. We loaded boxcars there. They shunted boxcar in, and we'd load shingles into those. And then we'd roll 600-pound barrels of tar up two sticks into the place and fill up the thing with tar barrels. That was heavy stuff. I used to make duroid shingles by opening the top of a bag, and there was a lot of goo down below, and you open the bag and you shook the powdered asbestos into it without anything on you. So I could probably sue for something there. But it wasn't a good thing. I'm lucky I didn't do much of it, because we didn't think of asbestos in those days. And we all were getting about the pay, about $1 an hour, if we're lucky, about 80, 90 cents is what all the kids got. But that just about paid our tuition. Tuition in those days was about $400.
And so you went then to Harvard at the end of... The end of this after you articled?
I went on to. Which did I do first? I think I went directly from the law school to Harvard rather than. I'll check back.
Well, actually, here you've said I articled it. Ferris and Company, and was called 1958, and did graduate work for a year at Harvard, then taught at Queens.
Yeah, I got some offers of different places just about the time I was graduating from Oxford, from Harvard, and I went to teach at Queen's University. And it was a brand new university. So, it was only 2 years old at that time. So it's sort of like my father had been coming out here teaching early. And I taught there for 5 years. Queens was a very good school. Mm-hmm. But it was real fun because you were teaching people who were the same age as you were practically. And so there was no distinction between town and gown at all. We went to the same hockey games and football games together, and partied together, and you couldn't tell the students from the faculty. Gradually, of course, that changed. We got older, but they stayed the same age. Because they kept incoming new every year.
What was your area of there, legal expertise?
Well, there I was teaching family law and mortgages, landlord and tenant. That was it. I think I had three courses. I might have had a fourth course.
How did you get back to UBC?
My father was dying. He had colon cancer, and he'd had one operation, and that saved him for 4 or 5 years, but then finally got him. And I knew that. We all knew that he was dying that spring, and George Curtis asked if I would come and fill that place.
So they knew, obviously knew you were at Queens and thought you were a good replacement.
I guess, yeah. I had an offer to go to Toronto, but I knew I had roots here. You know, I've been away for 5 years. Well, the other thing that Queens let me do was to come out here in the summers. The dean said, you can, you know, do as much research and stuff in the summer that you feel like, and at least you'll be back at the house. So I spent which was nice because the summers in Kingston are horrible. You know, Ontario in the summer?
I was in Toronto over the summer for about 4 years, and just humid and sticky.
Yeah.
Unpleasant in every regard. Except for the evenings. I did enjoy the evenings in Toronto. Were quite nice.
Well, I was sticky in Kingston. So I was very lucky to get out here for the summer. And I did some stuff for the firm, even though I had said I wasn't going to stay there. But I did some research for them during the summer because I had my degree.
Did you have an interview here at UBC, or did you have to go through that? Or they just you were a known quantity, I guess.
My father was here, and Curtis was here. As I say, there were only 7 professors on the first few years, but by that, I think it'd be up to about 12, 15, something like that. There will be somewhere that shows those figures.
Can you talk about Curtis a little bit?
Well, I've got an article, a long article about him when he died in the Advocate. And it's all there. And as I noted in the article, it happened to George Curtis in the same way. The war was there. My father was teaching in Alberta and during the war, and of course the classes got smaller and smaller, but they didn't quite die down. And the same thing was happening in Dalhousie, which is where George Curtis was. And in essence, both of them had to teach total curriculum. There were two professors teaching at Alberta as the war grew, and there were two teaching in Dalhousie. The two at Dalhousie were George, and that's all in my article, I always forget the other name, but he was well known. Later on, he was a well known teacher, and I've got that name in there. And here it was George and my father, and starting off and then gradually adding more teachers.
So he was one of the first two.
Well, when my father came here, there was a downtown teacher teaching. In fact, there was a couple, two or three downtown teachers filling in for George and my father.
So those were practicing lawyers who could take on students.
Yeah.
And where were those classes held? Did they come up here to teach at UBC?
Nobody went downtown. They all came out here and gave their services and did their teaching. One was a Crown prosecutor, Stan Remnant.
Remnant?
Yes, Stan Remnant. He taught criminal law for quite a while as a downtowner. And there were some... there was Fred Carruthers. Well, you'll get all those names coming in. I'm sure that probably... what's his name?
Wes Pugh?
Wes Pugh will have all that in his book, sort of.
Fred Carruthers, he was labor.
He was labor, wasn't he? Yeah, I took labor law from him. And Jack Austin came out here. Later on, Jack Austin was something in the government, wasn't he?
There was a Senator Austin, if that...
He might, yeah, John, that might have been... You'd have to chase Jack Austin down. He's still around, actually. And he taught us almost the year after he graduated. And he taught us a couple of years, and then he was in practice. And then he was in politics for a while.
Who were some of the notable colleagues you had?
When I was here?
Yes.
I'd have to look at the list.
Yeah. Well, we actually had a list. I didn't bring it because it's so long. For those years, people came and taught for a year or two.
Yes. Well, that's one feature was, it was a special thing that would be interesting to you. And that was that there was a special tax deal for foreign, for mostly from England. Eric Todd was one. There was several, and they got a special tax deal because we were Charlotte professors. Not probably true across the country. I think Charles Bourne was one of those people, but he went I think first to one of the prairies before he came here. But he taught, I think he taught in Manitoba or Saskatchewan or something for a year or two, and then he was here. So we had we had that four or five Brits, if you like, as the number of teachers just grew. And you probably had their references to that probably in Wapu's stuff.
Yes, and we talked to, Leon Getz.
Yes.
Remembered there were two. Now I forget their names
Tony
too,
Hooper.
But they're sorry.
Tony Hooper one.
Yes, yeah. Tony Hooper. Yeah.
Tony Hooper became a senior judge. He's still over. I think he's still a senior judge. Although, and another one just recently died. Very tall one. And Leon would have known him. Well, we all knew. Yeah, there was a significant number of English professors who came over here and didn't basically stay, but put in some years here. Then there were the Americans. And in about 2 years, all of a sudden we had five Americans.
What was happening there? Was it the Vietnam era?
Yeah, it was the Vietnam era.
So these were sort of refugees?
Yep.
So they were...
They didn't like what was going on in the States.
Applying here so they could get away from that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And who were...
Bob Franson. I mean, if I saw the list, I could name all five. The guys who were next to me in the office is Bill Bob Black. There was one big tall guy that we called Abraham Lincoln because that's what he looked like.
We interviewed the guy who was the assistant librarian, Al Soroka.
Oh, Al, yes, yeah. Good man.
Yeah. Yes, he was a...
He was one, too. Yeah. Yes, I forgot the librarian, yeah. Yes, Al Soroka. Wexler. They all came up within about a two-year span. It was quite a sudden infusion.
Did they tell each other? Was there a kind of a telegraph?
I don't think so. I think they were all separate. They came separately. They didn't know each other necessarily at all. They came from different universities.
I think Canada was on the map then in kind of liberal America because it was an alternative to... It was seen as a place of sanity and...
Yeah. 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 There were five and some stayed. There was a very small one who's a major, well, he's getting as old as we're all as old maybe by now, but he's done very well in the States. He's in Texas. Scotty Poe, P-O-W-E. And he's a very senior teacher in Texas, and his books are very much regarded, highly regarded.
P-O-W-E,
I think. And I don't know what his real first name was because he was always Scotty. And he's quite short. And when he and Charles Burns happened to be standing near each other, they looked halfway. Because Charles was tall, very tall. Charles is very ill, old now. He's still alive, but not well.
We interviewed.
Excuse me. I think he may have passed away.
Born?
I think just
a couple of months ago.
You're right.
We were just beginning to make inquiries about talking to him when he died. So we missed him.
He was a very quiet, solemn sort of person, but he became very important in the constitutions of African countries, and also in the law of water and of oceans, that is, and he was a very significant, highly regarded. He's a very quiet man, and a very shy man, sort of, in some ways, but...
What was his training? Where was he? He was English.
He was English. He came from Barbados.
A colonial Barbadian.
Yes, and he taught in Saskatchewan in his first year, and he'd be one of those sort of came up under the income tax, probably. But he was a little older than the rest of those.
Yeah. We talked the other day to Carrie Linda.
Oh, Carrie.
Who was a student equivalent to those, the American faculty.
Yes, that's true, yeah. Yes, Carrie was a charismatic. There was the sit-in at the faculty club and things like that, and we had some interesting times.
Well, we had he was remarkable because he said, you know, this is all on the record. I don't mind. You know, I suppose he's at the end of his career. He's 70. And he...
Gary's
70, yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, he was a bit older. He came to UBC in, I think, in about 62. Or, but he was a bit older than most of the
his
hippies.
His father was quite a famous person, I think. An academic in the States.
The Harvard family.
Was it Harvard? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's him. There's a number of people, interesting people. We went through quite a thing about students wanting to get onto the faculty or having more faculty involvement, and there was some tension going on in there. And some of the faculty were pro, some of the faculty were con. So that was an era, certainly. Mm-hmm. I've got some pieces of paper that I run into in my back files that are sort of interesting in that.
Oh, that would be interesting to see those. And did you get time for sabbaticals and all this? Where did you...
I took a half-year sabbatical at Laval. I could find a year. Midway is sort of somewhere. And that was interesting because my French was lacking. I tried to learn as much as I could, but it was midwinter, and it was the cold, one of the coldest, and Quebec City is cold. Where have you been?
I've never been, but I have heard.
Well, luckily all the buildings are connected underground, so you're always underground from building A to building B, because it's 5 feet of snow above you. It wasn't a good half year, because they had a strike the first half of that year, and so they were just trying desperately to get the whole year in for the half year that was left from Christmas to the end. And so they were pretty busy, and I didn't get much out of it. I was comparing some Quebec law to BC law or to Canada as a separate. And I worked on that, but I didn't get too much out of that.
They're very different legal systems, aren't they?
They're basically, instead of case based, they're code based. Mm-hmm. There is this code, and it's fairly rigid, and you have this code, and then you have people who try and explain various parts of it. We go by sort of case law all the time. We don't go. Theirs is much more quote statutory, if you like. But I mean, it was an interesting time, and I met some nice people. I got cold, but that was a half sabbatical, and I had a full sabbatical in another year, which I could look up, and that was over in London at the London School of Economics. And I was halfway into work that I was doing, which was work on the estate tax, which Canada had, and which the state...
Estate tax.
I was working... I'd been teaching it a couple of years, and I wanted to work on it more, and I was working on it over there. And then all of a sudden, in about halfway through, Canada canceled its estate tax until there was no more estate tax. So one of my courses just disappeared off the face of the earth.
So that's a tax on an
tax
inheritance?
Tax on death, all the things you had after that, they took 10 or 15 or 20% of everything in the estate. Now, the only, basically all it came out to now is tax on... profits, the growth in the house that was once the capital gains tax became a substitute, but it wasn't nearly as cutting, it wasn't nearly as strong as the estate tax was.
Did they cut the estate tax for ideological reasons?
I'm not sure.
Because I think
basically so many people had managed to find a way around it and they had were always closing the loopholes, but new ones opened up, and that's what I was teaching. So this was much easier to administer, wasn't it? With one tax on it, and that's it, not your estate tax. So I gave up. I had to give up what I was doing, and I got a little discouraged. I took a haversack and I went to Greece.
That's a nice idea.
Well, I saw a lot of Europe in the last month or two.
Did you go on by train?
Went by train, or went in a jeep here and there in Greece and things like that. And I did get some. I did go. I did some work for some. I gave opinions for some law firms in London about Canadian law, and I also I went to a big huge conference in Australia, Singapore, where we discussed tax all over the place. I went back to England for a couple of conferences after that, but that was basically it. So I.
And did you have a family at that point?
No, I've always been single. Okay.
And I was going to ask earlier about what are some of the main changes you've seen in law and
in teaching law. As everybody can tell you, students tell you more than I can in a way. I don't know. I mean, the transition to the electronic age. We took notes. We created things called CANs. Or may still be doing, I don't know.
They still do, but I mean, they're all typed.
They're all typed, yeah. We had a guy who we sort of chased out because he was making quite a commercial concern out of somebody's notes. The guy who was a lecturer didn't really like that very much. I'd forgotten how it worked out, whether he was kicked out or what happened. But it's changed from The techniques now of students are quite different. They have all the books are online, and that's incredibly different. We would be struggling we'd have to take a book out and then take it back because somebody else wanted it. This way, you didn't have to do that. So they have a much faster access to the whole legal system and all of the cases. Whether that's better. I can't say whether it's better or not. I did a lot of. I was on the labor board. I was vice chair of the BC labor board for some years, and I got used to labor law as such, and then I. When I came back, I taught labor law, and I taught, and I'm still teaching it, in a sense, because when I retired, I stayed on 10 years giving a seminar in labor law, which I had the students around the room do a case and argue it and things like that, and I'm still doing that for the MOOT that I do. It has to change its name because the sponsors have changed, but anyway, it's the labor law MOOT. And I take two students down to Toronto and all the other eight law schools, and we compete. And that's fun, and those two get a very good training, by the way. Because I had a lot of friendly arbitrators downtown who helped coach all these kids. We ran them to the ringer night after night until they did well. But the students probably. Well, I guess it's hard for a current student to say how different it is because they've only done what they've known, and I've never lived out of a computer. I sometimes fight with one, but I haven't lived with it that way.
I think Graham's the last person
to
make notes in his. I think he's doing it right now.
Well, we made notes and we made into our cans, and some were good cans and some weren't. Some people made bucks off it, and some people didn't trust that and made it and took their own notes. But we used the library quite heavily, used the book heavily, and there were sometimes, if it was a popular textbook, it was, you know, there weren't that many copies. The cases were usually okay. So there was different dialing.
We talked to Shorthouse.
Mm-hmm.
Was it John?
Tom.
His son is the hockey.
Yeah, Tom is a talented musician. He's the kind of person that can sit down and play any tune he's ever heard. And he was good at plays and things like that. So Tom is very talented. And he was a very nice librarian. He was a great guy. I really liked him. Yes, I still see his son on broadcasting.
Yeah.
He's on the hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he talks about tires. I think he's got the ad for tires.
He does the spin-offs, as it were.
Yeah. No, Tom is great.
When I was doing a web search, I saw a McIntyre prize. Is that yours or your father's? A McIntyre.
There's a McIntyre entrance scholarship.
Scholarship, yeah.
Yeah, I started that.
And did you have to endow it, or did?
Yeah.
So you gave the initial.
I gave the initial, and of course the stock market did a lot of damage to it, so it's been hard to build it back up again. It isn't back yet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple little prizes of some sort for a smaller bit. Well, I shared one with Bertie McLean. Where was the highest mark in Succession, I think, which is Old Wills in the States. And I don't know that my class, some of the classes have a class of 76, a class of this. It's all in the book, except that the UBC doesn't publish books anymore about anything. You can't find directories, you can't find phone books.
No.
Jesus. It's maddening.
Everything's being converted to digital.
That's right. You're
digitized.
If you're not, if you haven't got a pad in your hand, you're thick.
Well, it's so interesting. You know, one thing I've noticed about these interviews is that obviously I'm learning a lot, but they're almost these oases, you know, of tranquility in the middle of emails and kind of rushing around, and I think something's been lost from the earlier era.
Yeah, you're going to have a much better feel for it. I don't know how much students gang together in groups two or three, or whether they have they agree to meet for five or six of them to talk about something. Or they do it all on their own.
I'm sure it happens. I can't say that I honestly have a regular study group or anything of that nature. But I certainly have some friends in classes that will bounce ideas off each other and ask each other questions. Nothing formalized, but I'm sure students still talk to the exact same extent.
Now, do you record your lectures from the teacher?
I don't record them, and I'm not sure what university policy is. I imagine that the lecturer would want to be asked to be recorded.
I was wondering.
I don't think they do it as a matter of course, and I've never seen anyone ask or not. It's of course entirely possible somebody's taking it, but yeah. I don't really know.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me to be an advantageous thing. I know I would rarely listen to the notes again. I'll go over my own notes.
You make notes, yeah.
And I'll do the readings and make notes from that.
We weren't into Blackboard or whatever you call it. Putting something up on the screen, and a lot of
overhead
PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that a lot of people use PowerPoint, and some probably don't. Does anybody use straight lecture?
Yeah, some people do it in that fashion. I think it's becoming less and less frequent, but certainly mm-hmm. one of the better lecturers here now, Nikos Harris.
Mm-hmm.
He just lectures.
You can hear him from either end of the building.
Exactly, but effectively, he has his notes. He'll diagram some stuff on the board occasionally, yeah. but no, he doesn't bring in anything else.
No, and you hear everything he says. Yeah, I taught him evidence. I know.
He taught me evidence.
Well, there's a translation for two generations.
What was your lecturing?
Oh yeah, I taught evidence.
Technique.
My.
Maybe fairly straightforward. Or did you?
I pushed for questions as much as I could.
What do you mean? You encourage students?
I wanted people. I liked getting good questions so I could talk about it. I didn't like just reaming it out like that.
Yep.
And if there was something that I thought was worth summing up in some ways, I would print something and hand it out. Put some interesting case in a way that I didn't have to talk about it because I could hand it out to them. I don't write on the blackboard very well, but I waited the blackboard, so I didn't have power. There were people using PowerPoint before I left, and I never used PowerPoint. I'm sure I should have, but I'm not great with computers.
You mentioned McLean, Bertie McLean. Is he still?
Bertie McLean is downtown, working about 2 days a week at the biggest firm. Not Lawson Lindell. It's one of the huge firms.
Blake's.
Blake Castles. I'm not sure that it's Blake Castles. That doesn't ring a bell. No, it's not that, but it's the biggest in town, I would think, almost. If I saw the name, I'd know it immediately. He's doing that, and he does, because he is a master specialist in trust law, and he's there. His wife isn't very well, so he's having to worry about that. But he was Bertie Wood, as he was called. Was a super lecturer, students like. Where were we?
I was going to ask who we should talk to. Obviously, we should talk to Bertie McLean.
Yes.
But are there other people who not necessarily from your year, but other faculty, other graduates of the law school who you might remember? Recommend?
All sorts of them, yes, but I don't know. I am not. I mean, Bertie, obviously. I'm trying to think of people who taught and then they're downtown so that they have that experience. Bertie is one. I don't know if any others are in the law firms or not. I haven't got a list of the faculty here in front of me.
Well, if you think of any, just drop me a line.
Yeah.
An email, and we're kind of working our way through. What happens is half a dozen people will say you have to talk to Jim McIntyre or to Bertie McLean, and then we.
Well, if you get some leads, I can come back and I can think of things. I mean, there was there's Ray Herbert was a very popular teacher, and his background was that he had a DFC for flying in the war, so he came in straight off the Air Force and into and he was very bright, The students liked him very much. He wasn't very organized, but he was He was a very beloved teacher. Yeah.
And he's around still?
Oh, no. Oh, he died about 20 years ago. Mm. But he was one of the very first, he was in that first five or six people. There was Ray, there was Gilbert Kennedy. Gilbert Kennedy was quite a different teacher. Of the six people, he's one of them. I mean, there was George, and there was Ray, and there was Doran, and there was Gilbert Kennedy. And I'm trying to think of the...
Your dad, obviously. Warren, and
my dad.
Carruthers, was he early?
Fred Carruthers. That was all the first 10, sort of. And if there's a name there you want to ask about any time, I can fill it in a bit. There's a special prize for Ray Herbert as for the most all-around student. He was a very close friend of my father. There were some professors who were sort of thought to be on the sort of stricter side, and there were some who were sort of on the easy side. Ray and my father were on the easy side, and Gilbert was on the strict side. George was pretty much good with everybody.
What was Ray's background? Where was he from?
He's from a Mormon background. He wasn't a Mormon, he came from the large Mormon place in Alberta, which is well known. I can't think of the name of the place. He joined the Air Force very early, probably underage, and he had a distinguished, he had a DFC. And was actively within the stayed with the Navy or Air Force in some function even after law school or after being teaching here.
And the other name I was going to ask about is Gilbert Kennedy.
Gilbert Kennedy was a Toronto product, I think. His father was a very well known. Law teacher in the East, and Gilbert was, I would say, on the strict side. He wasn't as quite as congenial as some of the others. He stayed for a long time, and then he moved over to the Attorney General's, or to the legal part of the government. And he one of the things he did was correct all the grammar in all the statutes and insist on it. He was known as for them doing that sort of thing.
A pedant.
Yes, you could say that. No, you can't say that.
Okay, we won't say it.
But you could think it. Yeah. But he worked hard worker, and he wrote a lot of good legal material. And he died some years ago. But there was Gilbert. And there was Gilbert and Freddie Carruthers. I remember one event. Because Gilbert sort of had, when we didn't have a real personal librarian, Gilbert acted as a librarian in the early days, but he was strict and the books had to come back, they were absolutely right. And I remember Fred Carruthers was working on an article of some sort, and he had books. Sort of like this on the table, the way you do when you're doing stuff like that. And Gilbert came in one night, and in fact, he couldn't take that, and he put them all back on the shelf. Well, of course, all the page numbers were. So that was a bit of a fuss. I don't think you can use that, but it's just the way things were. He was very strict. Then we got a very nice librarian, Diane, I've forgotten her last name.
Priestley?
Yes. She was a wonderful librarian, a wonderful person. They took her off to Victoria, and I think they named the library after her.
Took her to the law school there.
Because the second law school was Victoria, and that became the head of that was an awfully nice guy. You'll be able to find the name somewhere. There, I thought he wasn't the first dean, I don't think, but he was the best dean. But he died. He died almost the day that he retired.
Not Fraser?
Yes.
Murray Fraser?
Murray Fraser. Murray Fraser came out of Dalhousie. He was a Nova Scotian, and he was a superb guy. And it was superb, everything. And it was just, you know, he was still young, and they decided to retire. He never even got a day of retirement. And they're sad. Everybody loved him, too. He was very popular. And of course, the dean right to the end, here.
Sorry?
I say the dean here was still walking across the road the day before he died. I have a long article on him in the Advocate.
On Gage. On Curtis.
On Curtis.
Curtis.
There, it's a long article with three people. Three people wrote it. I wrote it as him as a scholar, and a couple other people wrote him as a neighbor and other things.
We'll look for that.
Yeah, that's pretty full stuff.
So the other, I know you want to get going soon, but...
No, it's 12:30.
I was going to ask about the students you had taught, who were notable or keep in touch with.
Well, I run into them in town, and I can't remember their name. Well, they're just lots of them that I can remember.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I was thinking was your you mentioned on the way upstairs that you were working as a I forget the name of your on a university committee.
Oh, committee. Well, that's just. I've been on dozens of university committees. No, that university committee I'm on is the discipline committee, and it's what happens. 9 out of 10 are problems with people's using materials
without plagiarism
without giving the sources, and we give them some discipline of some sort. And after what we were doing this morning was. If we found somebody, sort of convicted somebody and said, bad, you're out for the year or something like that, and it's written onto their transcript, then after 2 years they can come back and say, look, I've been a very good person after this, and I'm ready, but I'm nice now, and we look at it, and if they have, pretty well, but we did the two this morning, and said, yeah, okay, we'll take it off now, but it sticks on the... Well, that's one thing I did a great deal of was the LSAT. I was on the executive of the LSAT for many years. Now it is that, well, then Liz Isinger was. I don't think she's anymore. But that was quite a thing when we brought the LSAT in. It was a sudden. We didn't, you know, it came in a particular year that we started using it, and then that was very much part of the looking at a student to see if they were going to make it, because we had 200 places and we had 1,200 applications, and we had to winnow them down, and there was some controversy about us using an American test to let Canadian students in or out, but. The other thing was, well, obviously American students are much like Canadian students, basically, and that test has some validity. And if a person crashes out on that one, probably they're not going to get through law school. And there are only so many spaces to fill. And so I was with a committee, and we met. Actually, I got quite to know parts of the states, because they'd hold their meetings in Boston and in Chicago and in California. And so I was at least at two of those every year, and we went over what was going on in the LSAT and what changes should be made. And that was fascinating.
Is there any Canadian content in the LSAT, or is it?
No. No. It's I can't think of any situation where any Canadian would be in there. It's, you're given certain questions about that you read, and then you, I haven't taken it. At least, well, a friend of mine and I once started to, you know, had it, we were sitting around the table and said, let's look at this thing, because this kid was going to be doing it. And Alec and I, well, it's good that we didn't have to write this. Because it's tough mental stuff. And the judge, to some extent, it's vocabulary, not the meaning of what you're reading. And sometimes it's judgment about how you've read this paragraph and what is A writer, B writer, C writer, whatever. Did you write the LSAT?
Yeah.
Okay, you're much better.
Well, I think it's more or less, those are the first two sections. The only one that I think required any sort of specific training for, that or really preparation for, and that's what I prepared for, was there's logic puzzles. Uh-huh. And they can be various different permutations of, there are six people sitting around the table, John is sitting next to Stephanie,
yeah.
Charles is sitting next to Douglas, but Douglas, and you'll have to fill it in based on a series of rules. Those required a bit of study, but you could, there were strategies to approach it, and they're generally certain different models to follow. The reading comprehension, again, I don't think there's anything explicitly that you could study or prep for. It's basically being attentive, or there's analogy questions. Frequently, analogy was a lot of the, but like it's sort of like an advanced SAT in a way.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have any American feel to it. Was there any American stuff in there that you could have said?
Other than being American? Written in sort of a standard North American English, but there's nothing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't need to know any.
You wouldn't
be disadvantaged by being a Canadian in any way. Yeah. It would be similar between the two. I suspect if you came from any English-speaking country, it would be the same.
We did a lot. I did a lot with it because we were always trying to perfect it, and they'd come in with two things. They'd come in with their LSAT, and they'd come in with their grade average. And there had to be a combination of those two, which was better than one or the other taken singly. And there were little mathematics to it, which I never understood, but we developed for more or less, well, we did rank them by a combination of marks and things, and then when we had 1,000 people and we had 200 places, we would take the top 150, I'm not saying exact figures, but we'd take the top 150 as of the list, and then there'd be about 50 that probably had written in something in their application that triggered something in what we were thinking, and triggered something that maybe this person is worth, their LSAT isn't quite there in that big list, but they look interesting in some way, and they've written a very good statement about something. In any law school or any school, there's always a faculty all disagree somewhat on how much you use of, well, their story, their life story, and this sort of thing. Whose life story is better? This person had to raise 5 children, the other person only had to raise 3 children. Which is better? Mm-hmm. You know, the 3 got more from mom, but the 5 got better because they were 5. We all disagree to some extent with playing with these impossibles. But of course, the other is a very rigid thing, and you're playing with a scale. Because I was on the admissions committee for 20 years, so I got used to it. We did do the LSAT around the country. And in fact, I had to supervise a bunch of LSATs, just one or other. It was interesting.
We talked to Bob Reed. Is that
Bob Reed? Yeah.
Bob Reed. And he had a lot of good stories about both the admissions and placement at the other end of the other end of things both sound equally challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Were you on the placement end too?
Or? Oh, yeah. Yeah, one way or another, it was on a lot of them. I tell you, who was the chair one year? It was our Chief Justice candidate.
Yes.
What's your name?
The Akabuchi? Or the
no, the lady who's the Supreme Court of Canada was the.
McLaughlin.
Beverly McLaughlin,
right.
Was chair of the UBC. Well, that committee, when she was here, she was teaching here.
She's someone we should talk to.
Yes, you could. She's Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Is she?
Well, she was here for a while. I don't know. I think she may be from the Prairie originally, but I'm not sure.
I think she did her degree at U of A, but I don't know anything. I don't know really her.
Yeah. She isn't a UBC grad, I know that. But I think she did grow up in Alberta. Yeah, anyway,
were you ever a dean, or did you aspire to be?
I was associate dean two or three times. That's a job to do.
Yeah.
And things to fires to put out, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well. So anyway, that's probably all the questions we have.
Okay, you'll probably have more.
Yes, we can.
Because there's, you know, there's various people to talk about, things like that.
Mm-hmm. But and you can keep the list, the 57
list. I'm trying to remember, I can bring it with me.
But if you could sign the... on the second page, if you wouldn't mind.
I've got to read this.
Yeah.